So anyway, for this evening's talk, somebody asked me, can I give a talk about something deep? So tonight's talk is going to be on the Titanic. That's deep enough, isn't it? On gold mining, iron mining? No? Okay. But something a little bit deeper than usual. But I must say that a few times, whenever I want to give a talk about deep stuff, I can't, because you won't allow me. Giving a talk is not just me lecturing you. And I've told the other monks, I've taught them, you just look at your audience, you feel them, connect with them in quite a deep way, and just see what is necessary, what is needed, and just to how we can start with something reasonably simple and then build it up into something more deep than you expected you could ever hear or understand. And sometimes it just doesn't work. But anyway, I'm going to give it a try this evening. And one of the lovely things about this path called Buddhism is it's never dogmatic. The lack of dogma was something which was really interested me. You can challenge anything. And that challenge anything was a sign that you felt confident enough that you could do a path and find out the truth for yourself. And it's because of that lack of dogma that you started to have these little phrases that never let your learning stand in the way of truth. Whatever you learn from the Buddhism all those years in Sri Lanka or Thailand or wherever you've been, never let that take precedence over your experience. And to make that less an all over the place sort of path, you may also say that the path of Buddhism is a training. But not a training of the body. But you can see that quite clearly. But a training of the mind. And this was brought to my attention so easily this morning, because this morning I came into Dhammaloka early today, just after lunch, because it's part of our culture that sometimes there are Buddhists, this particular time Thai Buddhists, they're so busy running their restaurants and their family, they can't go to the temple every evening or every day, or even on important days, they've got their restaurant to run. So what they do, they invite once a year they invite us to go to their place, and we do some chanting and do some kindness, and they feed us, and they give us a donation as well. It's the only profession where they pay you to go to the best restaurants to eat their food. They pay us, we don't pay. It's always a wonderful time. But anyway, the restaurant was over in Elizabeth Quay, and it was called the Six Senses restaurant. I thought, Six Senses. That is just so Asian Buddhist, because in the West it's only five senses. And sometimes I remembered, apparently, there was a movie called The Sixth Sense. Of course, I haven't watched it, but it's all about a person who's got some ability to view ghosts or other beings or something, weird stuff. And that was called The Sixth Sense, in our Australian or Western culture. Hang on, that's not The Sixth Sense. It's probably a nice movie, I'm not sure, because people like weird stuff. But the real Sixth Sense is your mind. And one of the problems, as Dennis was saying, about going to this event on Tuesday evening to the Parliament to try and think about solutions to climate change. It's not just climate change, it's something more deep causing those problems. What's causing the problems? We've become a very materialistic society, thinking about things, rather than the sixth sense, the mind. you can see when we've only got five senses, that's materialism. And if people think, you know, just, oh, the mind is just some byproduct of the brain. No way. And I say that because, you know, I started off as a scientist, a theoretical scientist. I wanted to physicist. I wanted to do that because I wanted to find out the meaning of this world, this meaning of this life which I was in. And I thought that was one of the best ways to do it. And I was smart enough, but I was also rebellious enough. Rebellious enough to try and do things a different way, to try and see things in a different way, and to try and argue and ask the questions of all these great scientists. Some pretty good scientists which I was asking questions of. But always seeing that even in science there was a dogma there. This is not putting down science. Science does an incredible amount of really good work, but there's a dogma in there which I was rebelling against. Are you sure that's the truth? But what I did get from those times in science was to see just how limited my understanding of this world really was. And that to try and go deeper into the truth of this world, you had to actually to start expanding what your mind could understand. And a simile I usually give for this is, you know, one of the things which a lot of people have a lot of trouble understanding, the nature of time. And I love, as a monk, having the opportunity to really get to understand what time is. And to have these perceptions that your wanting, your craving, your needs create this concept of time. And when you don't want anything at all, when you're really still, content, then time slows down, even stops. What causes time? Wanting causes time. That's one of the reasons why. You know, this monks, and this is what we do for us, it's our profession. Some people learn how to play music and they're incredible on the guitar, on the violin. And amazing, and they practice so long on that. Some people are like carpenters or painters. But what monks do, we meditate. And then we've done so many hundreds, thousands of hours on meditation. You can see this happening. Sometimes you get so still in your meditation, time stops. There's no time left. You're still poised. And I think I said last week or somewhere that about, no, it's a few years ago now, but an example of that, weird stories which are true about the monk, Vietnamese monk, Theravadan Vietnamese monk in Sydney, teaching a meditation retreat. Start on Friday afternoon. First thing you do, half an hour meditation, then give a talk, a welcoming talk to everybody. Only when he started meditating, he got a bit too deep. He never gave a talk. He never went to bed. He never had breakfast, never had lunch, never drank anything, never went to the toilet for 8 days. Just sat there, just like a Buddha statue. Didn't move. Can you do that? Now, some people say, that's impossible, that happened. So still, they could just stay there, not sort of dead, but in deep meditation, don't need to breathe even. It's a really interesting stuff. And the reason I said that is to challenge what is possible in this world. So to change the idea of, sometimes we think, oh, it can only be this way, that can't happen, it's impossible. Impossible things actually do happen, they're not really impossible. It's just widening our understanding of what this world really is and how powerful this mind can be, this sixth sense, much more powerful than the body. And just to let you know, just I won't let you know who that name of that monk was because you don't want him to have too much attention, because that was just too much bother. But as soon as he came out after 8 days, he apologized. I'm terribly sorry, I just got into a too deep meditation, time lost its meaning. Fair enough, that's what happens. But anyhow, that time. I say this a few times because it's a nice way of just showing how we can expand our perception, what's possible, and a way of looking at things to answer some very deep questions, some very powerful, fundamental questions about the nature of our life. And it starts off with, you know, sometimes we think we're all really smart, and we all know that the world is round. It's an orb. But 300, 400 years ago, people thought it was flat. And if I wasn't taught at school, I would think it was flat. You can actually see the ocean and you can walk flat. It doesn't seem to have much curvature, but we all know that planet Earth is a sphere. It's got limited area, which is why we're overpopulating it right now. It's got limited area, but it's got no beginnings or ends. That is why I know that when I grew up, because I grew up in London, all the maps had London in the centre. That was the centre of the world. And poor old Australia was in the bottom corner somewhere. It's really unfair. That's not true. It's not on the edge or anything. And they had China was supposed to be the middle land. And where the Buddha grew in the Sanskrit ideas, that was the middle land, the middle earth. And that's also not Harry Potter, it's Tolkien, isn't it? The Lord of the Rings, the middle earth. Why does everybody want to be in the middle, in the center? I quite like the idea of being on the edge somewhere where people don't bother you. But we all know there is no middle, there is no bottom corner, there's no top or left or anything of planet Earth. It's round. It's a sphere. And then we go to space. And of course, space was something, as a young kid, excited me. And that was the time of getting rockets going into space. We're trying to explore space, and telescopes were just seeing all these amazing galaxies. I remember one of the experiences I had as a student, you know, with my friends, we went to go and sit, for those of you my age, you know, 2001, was it 2001, A Space Odyssey? 2001, A Space Odyssey. It was a really freaky film. And after seeing 2001, A Space Odyssey, then I was a member of the Astronomical Society, and they had all these old observatories, just like you see in the movies, these big domes, with incredible, powerful telescopes. And because I was a member, I told my friends, hey, we can just go and have a look. That was, you know, part of being a member. So I went over, cycled, I was very healthy in those days, cycled out outside to the observatory, and that was, I think, they found Pluto or Uranus on that observatory, but it was just out of date now. But anyway, we got in there, somebody said, oh yes, a really good time. This is 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night after the movie. And they said that you can see Saturn was up there. And so you could go in this chair and this huge long telescope, and just the hemisphere dome of the observatory would open. And it just had atmosphere. I know that some people have these tiny telescopes, you can see much more, but that's got no atmosphere. This was like something out of a science fiction movie, and you could actually see Saturn with its rings in huge magnification. It was gorgeous. Those sorts of things excited you about what is the nature of this universe? Because Saturn is just, you know, it's like you're almost like your next door neighbor, you know, a few blocks away, but not that far away. What else is out there? So, you know, having the opportunity to study physics and the astrophysics of the galaxy, that was one course I did. And that was actually the guy who was the teacher of Stephen Hawking's, Professor Sharma. He taught this astrophysics of the galaxy. That was such a cool subject. And sometimes I remember at that class being so, not freaked out, but so inspired, I couldn't take any more notes. I just inspired by what he was talking about, just how huge this is, the galaxy, and so many other galaxies in this universe, and the fact that this universe in which we live incredibly vast and empty, but this universe is limited volume, but no edges on it. There is no middle, no end. Like planet Earth, it's a curved universe. Expanding curved universe, which means there is no edge to it at all. A universe which is limited in area, in volume, sorry, but no beginnings, no ends. That took a long while for to get it into your head and see this universe in a totally different way. There is no middle, there's no center, there's no end. Beginningless, without an end. Wow, that was so cool. And then, of course, being a monk, then you start to do the same thing to time. Why should time be flat with a beginning and an end? Why can't time be curved and at the same time expanding? An expanding, curved time, because that is what's happening to space. So in other words, no beginning to time. No end of time, curved, always expanding, so you can't reach from one part to the last part. You can't go around in a circle, even though it is a circle. It's beyond your ability to explore the whole thing. And I thought, wow, that means we don't need to worry about creation, a god, or Armageddon, or anything. It's a beautiful way of answering some of the deepest questions of existence, just by seeing things in a different way, in a more expansive way. So how can you actually even get those ideas to begin with? And it's because in this path of Buddhism, there's a wonderful thing of, you know, not just being stuck by the old ways of doing things, not having dogma, but having a training. That training, for those who are traditional Buddhists, the old Eightfold Path, and especially in just having this right intentions, motivations, it's the second factor of the Eightfold Path. You know what that second factor is? Are they still over there, the letters? What does it stay in front here? Because I come in the back door, so I don't see. May peace, be kind, be gentle. That is the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. That's why we've got it on there. Very deep teaching, but so easy to understand. That is a quality of truth. Simple, you can understand it. May get a while to get it into your head. Make peace, be kind, be gentle, which is the most important part of meditation. The meditation I taught this evening, that's what I was doing. Relax your body, make peace with it, be kind to it, be gentle. And you get these incredible states of relaxation. Do the same to your mind. Because I haven't really explained too much about the mind yet, sometimes it takes a while for us to understand. So look at your piezometer. That's some part of your mind which is really important, which any one of you can know. Your piezometer, nothing to do with your body. It's your mind. How peaceful is it? And then when you can, just make peace, be kind, be gentle. You find you get into some very, very quiet states of mind. And one of the things which happens when you have such a quiet state of mind, again, your body starts to disappear. You're still very much alive. You're not dead. But you can't feel your body. Now, you know, when I was in Thailand, that was so helpful for me. Because this was 46, 47 years ago now. and it was in the northeast of Thailand. And you think, oh, what a beautiful, simple place that was. I won't talk about the food you had to eat there, but no, even what you only had to eat food about, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes in the morning time. But what was really a torture was the mosquitoes. Those mosquitoes, because we were forest monks, not city monks. And it's in the forest, that's where the mosquitoes lived, in the jungles. And those mosquitoes, Ajahn Chah insisted we sat for 2 hours every evening, you know, under the trees, between 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock, which everyone would know is mosquito dinner time. And worse, in this part of the world, that it was not a tourist attraction, there was not waterfalls or mountains, it was pretty flat. And because of that, this was the first time those mosquitoes had ever had Western food. And of course, it was just something new. So they'd all go and eat me and the other Western monks, and the Thai monks, they left alone. They didn't get in at all. So Ajahn Chah couldn't understand just what it was like to have 60 or 70 mosquitoes on your arm at one time, because we would count them. Oh, that was so irritating. Fortunately, there was no malaria there or dengue fever or anything like that, but it was really irritating. And of course, what's your response to such irritation? Get up and run away. I've thought about that many times, but I opened my eyes and there was Ajahn Chah not far away. And other times, you know, you saw the Thai monks, they were sitting perfectly still. And of course, you know, you had this Western sort of pride. Well, if they can enjoy it, so can I. I was having a tough time. But you found the solution was, again, to do your meditation, make peace, be kind, be gentle, relax the body, until the body just was not, you weren't aware of your body anymore, you're aware of your mind. You went inside the 6 senses, the 5 senses, sort of vanished. So you couldn't feel your arm. You didn't know what your mosquitoes were doing with it. You didn't care, because you're just, when you go inside, it's so delightful. Already, now I'm doing this quite often these days, even relaxing your body is a beautiful feeling, it's a delightful feeling. People pay money to get a massage, or to have a hot bath, or go to a jacuzzi, as I learned exactly what it was last week when I asked somebody afterwards. I'm a monk, you don't see jacuzzi. Actually, I do see jacuzzi, I didn't know what it was. You know, you don't watch the TV, it doesn't get advertised, you don't sort of indulge your body. Actually, do I indulge the body? I think I probably do indulge the body, but much better than you do, and it's all for free. Meditating, go very deep and very peaceful. And so you feel this delight in your body. Everything just, you know, starts to relax, and it feels lovely. And then you do the same to your mind. You really relax it. And again, it's another thing which, you know, I've really pushed in all the years I've taught. It's not force. Relax to the max. You know that word, you know, that's, I've invented quite a few words or phrases, you know, make peace, be calm, be gentle. I didn't invent that, but I did translate it and put it in front here. Relax to the max. One of the nuns over in the UK told me yesterday that one of her friends, who was a meditator in the Burmese tradition, said, oh no, I don't sort of put effort in anymore. He said, I just relax to the max. And I was just laughing. I said, I don't know where that one came from. And anyway, to relax to the max, your mind. Don't try and focus. Don't try and keep it on something. Don't use force. That makes you tired. And it's very unpleasant. So you just relax so much you don't want to go anywhere else. You're just here, content with where you are, and it's just so beautiful. What that does is what we call, it leads you to this states of samadhi. That's the last factor of the Eightfold Path. It's how the Buddha taught. It leads to what we call the jhanas. And when the Buddha, after the Buddha passed away, there was lots of people would ask, what actually did the Buddha teach? what type of meditation did the Buddha teach? And he would always be answered by his disciples, especially this one is by his disciple Ananda. And he said, oh, the Buddha only recommended four types of meditation. Is there any meditation the Buddha recommended? And that was first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. That's all the Buddha recommended. But. Isn't that just indulging in happiness? And the Buddha said, yeah. This is when the Buddha was alive. This is Pasadaka Sutta. That one was Gopaka Moggallana Sutta, the one before, 128. This was in the Pasadaka Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. I'm saying this because there's people overseas listening to this and checking me out, I'm sure. And in that sutta, the Buddha said something wonderful, powerful. That in his deep meditation, it's very delightful, incredibly joyful. And he said, isn't that dangerous? The monks can get so attached to the joys of meditation. Lay people too, nuns as well. Can you get attached to the joys of meditation, the bliss states? And the Buddha said, yes. You can get attached to those states. But, said the Buddha, anyone who gets attached to the joys of those four deep meditation states, there are only four possible results. The first stage of enlightenment, the second stage of enlightenment, the third stage of enlightenment, or the fourth, final stage of enlightenment. It makes you enlightened by attaching those beautiful bliss states. And that was just a powerful teaching to me, because we always feel being attached is always going to be a problem for you. And to make it quite clear, I always tell people that if you're going home on a motorbike, as the, you know, on the back seat of a motorcycle, please be attached until you get home. Sometimes attachment is important. There's only some attachments that cause you problems and suffering. So there we go. Those deep meditations, they lead. They're not enlightenment itself, but they're the cause of enlightenment. And I'm not saying this because this is just monks and nuns get these deep meditations. Lay people do too. You guys do. If you learn how to let go enough. And when you do, well, you bliss out. The bliss of those states, just to say that how possible it is, this is a self-deprecating story. Because over in Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center, that's why we named it Jhana Grove. And I never named it that. That was actually Ajahn Wayama, one of our first nun. So what name she? She said, call it Jhana Grove. I said, oh yeah, I like that. That's why it's called Jhana Grove, Deep Meditation Grove. And anyway, that I was, you know, I taught so many retreats over the years. And I was just hanging around there at the beginning of the retreat, and one guy came in a bit late. Those of you who've been on retreats, you've heard me say this story before. That, and I was hanging around, I saw this guy come in. He was quite a tall Australian guy, and he was wearing, well, it's an old joke, traditional Australian dress, national dress, sorry, which was shirt, so t-shirt, shorts and thongs. It was a warm day, I think it must have been the January retreat. And anyway, he also had lots and lots of tattoos all over him. And fuzzy hair. And, okay, I'm a monk, okay, I don't get out enough maybe, I'm not sure, but I looked at him and I said to him, sir, this is a meditation retreat center. The prison where you probably want to visit some of your friends is about 6 kilometres up the road, which is true. That's Carter Prison Farm. Because that's what he looked like. He never looked like somebody I expected to come on a meditation retreat. I'd never seen him before. And there is a prison farm just 6 kilometres up the road. And I thought he'd come in the wrong place. And so people have actually been there looking for the monastery and said, any monks in here? And it's Karnak Prison Farm where they ask that question. It's very embarrassing. But anyway. And so, you know, he said, no, I'm on your retreat. And his name was there, so, okay, fine, I'm sorry. I just made a mistake by judging a person just by what they look like. And the reason I tell that story was, during that retreat, he came up to me, and he was saying about he had a very nice meditation experience. He was glowing. I thought, wow, this might be interesting. I don't mean to have light, I mean just, you can see the emotional happiness and joy. And then he just was describing, he'd experienced one of these jhanas, first jhana. A person I never expected would be able to do it, but did it. Yeah. Why is it so happy? There was another guy. Girls actually have much more success than guys, I must admit. This is just my experience. But anyway, this other guy, he was a heroin addict. And you know, he tried so many things to get off heroin. And he was a guy who just came to stay at Bodhinyana Monastery for a couple of weeks to try and cold turkey. Such a difficult thing to do. And he had this beautiful wife who just really looked after him, said, we're going to give this a try. And of course, it's beautiful energy in a monastery. It's so supportive. And of course, there's no drugs which they can take or find. You have to go out and use your iPhone or something to call up to get some drugs. And he was doing so, so well. I think 2 or 3 weeks, I think, he was managing. But the way he told me, he said it was just so tough. Because his 100 times a day, sometimes 1,000 times a day, he has to say no. Just one time he says yes, and he's back on the addiction again. And unfortunately, after about 2 or 3 weeks, he said yes, and he was back on the addiction again. And the way he described it to me, you can feel just how difficult that is, you know, once you have an addiction like that. You know, it takes such a while. And it's just constant, the constant craving, the constant addiction. And you have to keep saying no, 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 no. And it takes a long time before that just fades away. And one time says yes and got to start all over again. But anyway, the reason I tell the story was that, you know, I taught him some meditation and one day he just got a deep one. And he, I don't know why this is, he came running towards me. All these times people came running towards you. And because I was, I think, coming into Nolamara for the weekend, and he said, Ajahn Brahm, I've got to tell you this before you go. He said he got a deep meditation experience, and he said it was more blissful than heroin. And he said, I thought I'd never tell anybody that, because in my whole life I've never known anything which was more pleasurable than a hit of heroin. He said, you know, much better than sexual intercourse, much better than anything else which I've known. But now, this meditation is far more beautiful than that. Unfortunately, he couldn't get back into that thing, so back into heroin instead. The ideal of a human being wanting to go for happiness, for joy, for bliss, is a very strong pull. And that's where you get into, in these deep meditations. Now the thing is, that deep meditation, it's especially something like the first of these deep meditations, jhanas. Very blissful. You, as you knew yourself, aren't there anymore. Because this is your mind. We call it the jitta, the mind, in the sixth sense. The 5 senses, physical senses, have gone. You can't see. Even if you opened your eyes, it's been turned off. You can't even hear. Somebody talks to you, you can't hear them. And you can't feel, smell or taste. All those 5 senses are gone. They come back later on, so you just got your mind very powerful, very aware. You're not unconscious, totally opposite. You're fully aware. When you are fully aware like that, blissed out, but very still. That is the nature of a mind which is freed from the 5 senses for a while. And this is also where some people misunderstand. If you think that that is the end of stuff, you come up afterwards, and many people have these experiences. Sometimes they feel that it's a union with God. Why? And if you've had enough of those experiences, it's pretty simple to understand why. It is because your sense of self, who you think you are, male, female, that's body stuff. Sri Lankan, Singaporean, Thai, Australian, whatever, indigenous, that's body. This is actually something which transcends that body totally. Because the five senses are part of the body. That's what the body is. The activities and the means by which the five senses can play around in this world. But when those five senses vanish, whew, you've got something much more fundamental, your mind. I don't mean the thinking mind, I mean what actually was doing that thinking when it was disturbed. And you get some incredible insights. First of all, just like I just mentioned, thoughts. What are thoughts anyway? Thoughts are just the mind being disturbed. So often we have these similes, archetypal similes, which go to many races, religions, cultures of our world. Understanding the mind or symbolizing it by a lake, by a body of water, by a pond if you like. And the thoughts are the waves on the surface of that pond. It's a disturbance of the mind. And when your mind gets very still and satisfied and peaceful, there are no thoughts. It's like a clear pond with no ripples on the surface at all. And even now, so if you happen to go into a forest or a park and it's really calm and peaceful and you go and sit by a lake and it's not even a ripple on that surface, it's like a mirror. It's very, for one reason or another, it's really inspiring. It's beautiful. To the point that in, I think in Korean, Japanese mythology, or not mythology, culture, the only way to see the full moon is as a reflection in a still forest pool. But anyway, that's giving some idea of the beauty and even the joy of those that state. The Buddha actually called it, it's amazing, sort of the joys, he called it even like enlightenment happiness, Sambodhisukha. This is the first jhana. It's not enlightenment happiness, but it gives you a taste of what enlightenment really is. Incredible, powerful bliss. I'm just quoting from our texts. And when a person does experience even that, it's just too easy to think that that's the end. Powerful bliss. Your body has vanished. Now, of course, if you don't have any more understanding, if that's where you stop, you don't push the boundaries, you take that as a dogma, that is where the concept of an original mind, sometimes they call it amata citta, and this is a concept which comes up again and again and again amongst many learned Buddhists. If you just stop at that jhana or one afterwards, sometimes you feel that that's the end. And that actually is, for some Hindu traditions, enlightenment, samadhi. Stillness, the first jhana, beautiful. Because I remember just talking with many people, and there was an ashram over in the Blue Mountains outside of Sydney, very close to Wat Buddhadhamma, you know, where Venerable Kema Varro is. And there they would say, well, if you get a beautiful blue nimitta, nimitta is the lights which precede jhanas in the mind. And you merge into that one, then that's it, you're enlightened, end of the story. And I said, that's not enlightenment, that's just the first of the deep meditations. Because what happens next is that first deep meditation goes into a deeper one. It's like you go up to a mountain and you think that's the highest in the world. And then you find there's another mountain higher, and one higher still. And each one of these deep meditations has got just more bliss, more profundity than one before. And each one has more things which are missing. And that's one of the reasons why the insight practice, which will always come after the experiences of samadhi, as the Buddha said so many times, samadhi paccaya yata buddhiyana dasana, it is the stillness, the deep meditations, and the causes for insight and understanding the way things truly are. And if you get that still, when you come out of that meditation, your mind is what they call the free from the distorting hindrances of the mind. This is where you get so courageous and rebellious. There's not a dogma left in you. You see what's really there, not what you want to see, not what you don't want to see. Your mind is still, not restless. It's not dull, it's powerful energy. And no doubt left. You've just had incredible experiences. This is where insight comes. And to give you a nice easy simile to understand this, it doesn't matter how deep it is, you can always find some simile somewhere. And this was a simile which some of you have heard on these retreats when I teach that stuff, of the tadpole. So once upon a time there was a little tadpole. A little tadpole lived in a pond in a retreat center somewhere. And little tadpole, you wouldn't believe this, but you know, sometimes some lakes are very advanced these days. This lake, this little pond, it had a school. And so tadpole went to school in the pond, because it's a Buddhist school. Didn't matter if it was a male or female, they all got a good education. Now, equity. Treating people not because of their race or gender or age or disfiguration any different than anybody else. So everyone treated with respect. So little tadpole went to school. She was very clever. She went to high school, did year 12s, went to university. And she majored in chemistry. Because she, just like myself, you know, when I was a student, I wanted to know, where was I living? What was this place called life, the universe, time, which I was born into? Tadpole wanted to find out, what is this thing called water, which I was born into? And I went to university and found out it was H2O, with a few other stuff in it. And really was an expert on water. But of course, how can a tadpole know what water really is? No more than a fish can know what water is. You're born in it, you lived all your life in it. But the difference between a fish and a tadpole is that one day, little tadpole, she grows appendages. She didn't even quite know what they are at first. Little arms and legs. She is transforming into a frog. And once she's a frog, she doesn't really know what she's doing. They don't teach her this in school. She jumps out of the lake. The weirdest experience she's ever had. Just like little tadpole human being, you grow these abilities to still your mind, to sit quietly, to be so free of your five senses. You're not in the lake anymore. You're not in your body and its five sense world. Little tadpole is now outside the lake, sitting on dry land. And little tadpole, no, so now Mrs. Frog, I can't say Mrs. Frog, Miss Frog, because I don't know about being married or something. Do frogs get married? I don't know, I suppose they do. Anyway, that's another story. But anyway, squatting on dry land, number one, totally different than anything it's known before. Number two, it can soon find out what's different about this. Something which has always been there has now gone, vanished, disappeared. In Pali, that is anicchad. It's impermanent, it's gone. You always think it's there. How can you not know? Or sorry, how can you know what water is when it's always there? How can you know what your body is and your five senses? It's the first thing which vanishes in the deep meditations. Much more than any doctor can ever know, because your body has vanished and gone. And you're still there. Or rather, a mind is there, not you as you know it. And of course, that's why when people think, oh, when they die, oh, that's what's left. Of course, it's still moving. There's more to it than yet. But one thing, even a first jhana experience, you come out of that afterwards, you have to be just, oh, even Freddy the Frog would know that means that there's such a thing called reincarnation, rebirth. That death doesn't stop you. It's your own personal experience, it's obvious. Your mind is independent of your body. It's a sixth sense, nothing to do with the five senses. It plays with the five senses, can live independently. Which is why, now you understand what happens after you die. It's like a death, but you just come back again afterwards with that knowledge. And something's missing, the body. But what happens next? If you go into the next jhana, it's more interesting. Because then, what disappears next is your will. That's freaky for many people. Choice disappears. Don't worry, he had no choice that had to happen. Will vanishes. She's sitting there perfect and really still now. Aware, but not able to do anything, no choice. This is where you understand what the will is. You know, a lot of times, if you haven't had that experience, people think that they're in control of their will. It's yours to exercise if you want, if you don't want. And it's one of your prized possessions. So prized that we have legal constitutions of countries to preserve our will, the freedom to pursue happiness or whatever. Was that the United States Constitution? Is that really a freedom? Or is it being in a prison? If you can get to a second jhana, you'll find this thing we call will, which people cherish. Feel so proud of all the wonderful things you've achieved. Feel ashamed of all the things which you failed at. You feel your will is yours. And it really starts to trouble you when you find out it's not yours. It's just a phenomena which causes you a lot of disturbance and pain. The will is suffering. When you stop the will, peace at last. It's not yours, it's not part of you. But for most people, it's what I call one of the two citadels of the self. The two places where your identity hangs out. You are the one who chose to come here this evening. No, you didn't choose to come here this evening. It was caused. Very complicated, but you ask any psychologist why you do things, why you have your hairstyle, why you eat this and why you watch that and where you go, why you speak the way you do. Very conditioned. And there's more to come yet. Your will vanishes. Then you get so still and a lot of the things which you call as joy and happiness start to disappear. But then your mindfulness starts to disappear. For those of you who have read all of this in the suttas, or gone to Ajahn Bhamani's excellent classes on this, you'll find that the thing we call mindfulness, which is a very popular word these days, it reaches its peak, its purity, in what we call the fourth jhana. You can't get more mindful than that, more aware. So still, nothing moving, but perfectly knowing. And sometimes people can even think that that might be the end. That is the ultimate conscious state. But even that is unstable. What is still has to vanish. Your brain and your mind only knows things which move. Just like a computer, if you don't click the mouse, it turns off your computer screen. Same with your mind. So after a while, after a fourth jhana, something else starts to vanish. That is your mind. Your consciousness, your awareness starts to fade away. And that teaches you something very important. And even your consciousness, your mind, your citta stops. When it does, for those of you who look at the text, and it's great you look at the text, they're there, they're well translated, it's it's the cessation of perception and feeling. Everything stops. Even awareness stops. What does that teach you? What's the point of that? It shows you, just like the world, like your body, that's not yours. It's just a process. So what is yours? Nothing. As Ajahn Chah always used to teach, Wang, empty, nothing there. And that story, I think it's in one of my books somewhere, that when he tried to get enlightened me, he said, Brahm, Ajahn Brahm. He didn't call me Ajahn Brahm because he was the Ajahn. Brahm Awangso. Why? The wonderful story. Why? I said, I don't know. And he laughed. Stupid young monk. But then he said, I'll tell you the answer. Why? What are you doing in this world? What's the meaning of life? What is this world? What is this body? What is this awareness? This mind? What is you? What is pleasure? What is pain? What is this? Why? He asked me. And he said, I'll tell you the answer. It's the answer to the question, why? It's a beautiful answer. He said, there's nothing. There's nothing. He said, do you understand? I said, yes. He said, no, you don't. Wonderful put down. But the answer there is incredibly powerfully deep. There's nothing. No eternal consciousness. No deathless consciousness. No supreme consciousness. The Buddha kept on saying that so many times, again and 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 again. Everything stops. So what's the point? You've started. Otherwise you go round and round and round, birth to birth to birth. Sometimes much better than others. But after a while, just like that person in Groundhog Day movie, you get fed up. It's time to stop. You let go. And little by little, you vanish. And you stop. Gone. Gone. Gone forever. Which is a nice place to stop this talk. So I hope some of you enjoyed that. The Titanic talk. Very deep. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Here we go. Now get some questions. See if I've upset a few people. So I'm not upset, but sometimes scares you. We always look for continuation and for going to some happy heaven realm where we can be happy ever after. Okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so if you need to ask a question, there's two microphones there. There is a third way. If you really need to ask a question, you don't want to go to the microphone, please, you can shout it out and I will repeat it.
Okay. I'll come over with a microphone.
Okay, we'll be the microphone, okay. So, question number one, we've got four questions, so five, six, oh my goodness. This is from Toronto. Is there attachment associated with feeling sad when seeing the suffering of others? Obviously, sadness rooted in selflessness. It can be an attachment as seeing the unhappiness in others. It makes you unhappiness, makes you unhappy. It's like catching the bug from somebody else who's got the bug, which means that two people are in trouble. So, if you see the suffering of somebody else, let's make it easy, just with one person, what are you going to do about it? Sometimes we don't know how to overcome suffering. It's the way the Buddha said, it's like the only person who can take somebody who's caught in the mud, stuck in the mud, is if they're, you know, on the dike of the paddy field. And then you can actually got something solid underneath you to pull them out. If both of you are stuck in the mud, you can't pull them out. So if you see someone else is suffering and you're suffering as well, you're both stuck in the mud. So sadness rooted in, is there sadness rooted in selflessness? No, not at all. The sadness is rooted in a sort of a self. You know, sadness, what is sadness anyway? Who is sad? It can be a negative feeling, but it doesn't really help anybody. So instead of being sad, and not just laughing at people, but having this equanimity, peace, not sadness, and then you can help others. So often, you know, that going into hospitals, you see people suffering. And I just managed to teach a lot of people, don't talk to the sickness or the pain or the... That's the job of the doctors, you go and talk to the person. That story about that Tibetan nun, years and years and years ago, and she was in the hospice in Osman Park, when it was still open years and years ago. That's the one where she called me, she said she was going to die in a couple of days, and it was true, she died in 2 or 3 days. When I went there, there was this this nurse, she was the matron, head of the whole sort of hospice. She said, "Who are you?" I said, "Oh, I just come to see this nun." I said, "I'm sorry, she doesn't want any visitors." "Well, she just called me, just, you know, an hour ago, I just dropped everything to come see her, she's dying." Soon. "I don't care about that. We've got to respect our patients' wishes. But I've come such a long way." No, I'm rebellious. You know, I just argue with people, as many people know. So anyway, she took me to the door. She said, "Come with me," this nurse. And I followed her. And under the door was this big sign. "Absolutely no visitors." And then, you know what's happening? I'd enjoy telling this story. So he said, "See?" I looked at it, absolutely no visitor. Yeah, it's right. Except at the bottom, except for Ajahn Brahm. And I could not resist it. I couldn't resist telling you again. I pointed to the disclaimer at the bottom, except for Ajahn Brahm. I said, "See?" She was really upset. But we can't object to the patient's wishes. So anyway... So I went in. "Why did you put that up there?" He said, "Because you're the only person. I'm dying." You know, she was really, really thin and weak, no, not like the person you knew when she was healthy. "You're the only person who treats me like a human being. You're not sad seeing me." It wasn't. I was like, joy seeing a good old friend. He said, "Everyone else has their emotional baggage, say, being in hell. I've got enough baggage myself. I just need someone to please, Ajahn Brahm, tell me the latest joke." And that's what we did for about an hour. A bit of advice also, but I never felt sad seeing her in her dying days. She's a good person. So be careful, because sometimes your attachment can stop you rebelling and seeing something much more powerful. In Kyoto, the next one. "Dear Ajahn Brahm, I am a grad student, and the one thing causing time to exist for me currently is the number of papers I've been procrastinating on for months now. I feel a strong desire to complete the program I started, but whenever I sit down to work on them, my mind just grinds to a halt and I feel overtaken by anxiety, perfectionism, and a heavy feeling in my head. How do I overcome these barriers?" Look, put off procrastination to another day. And do the work now. And don't try and be perfect. That's the problem with people. They sometimes they always try and do a perfect paper, just good enough, it passes, that's enough. From Nathan, Ajahn Brahm, it seems that everyone around me right now is sad. I want to show them meditation, but they pass it off as my thing. How can I help them? Thank you. Sometimes you can't help them by talking. But if you just sit down and meditate, and they will watch you, and afterwards they'll come out and think, wow, you've looked so much more peaceful and happy afterwards. Sometimes there's many ways of encouraging people, not just by words, but by example. Then they'll come and ask you questions. Oh, I can't resist this story. This was when I used to go teaching meditation down in Bunbury, in the prison down there. And in the afternoon, I had a free afternoon. And the reason I tell this story, because it happened in November, I don't know how many years ago now. And so the beach was empty. I walked, you know, not away from the city, you know, a mile or 2 miles or something, and there's some houses and other things on the other side there, but no one was on the beach. It was a very beautiful, sunny, cool afternoon. I just sat down there and meditated for 2 hours. And when I came out of my meditation, beautiful meditation, there was people on the beach. I didn't mind that. There was someone sitting next to me, and someone sitting on the other side. You've heard this story before, haven't you? Now, I'm a monk, okay? The person sitting on my left was a beautiful redhead in a bikini, 17 years old. And I turned around, it was a brunette on the other side, also in a bikini, sitting next to me on the beach with a celibate monk in the middle. How did that happen? Just opposite was Bunbury High School. And it was the last exam in the year 12. So they just finished it that day in the afternoon. And what do students do after finishing their year 12 exams? Yeah, the beach. Get into their bathers and go to the beach. And I'd been meditating peacefully. I didn't hear them or know what they're up to. And two of the girls there, they're very beautiful young ladies. And they saw me and they saw me really still. So they sat and they were actually waiting for me to come out of my meditation so they can talk. What the heck are you doing? That's really impressive. But for me, that was very scary. If one of you had taken a photograph, or someone had taken a photograph, fortunately it was the day before iPhones, how could I explain that? I'd have been in big trouble. So sometimes don't try and be perfect. It's the perfection which is stopping you doing it. You know, but it's so hard these days. What is it, even Michelle Obama, the previous First Lady, you know, she always thought she was imperfect as a First Lady. She did an excellent job. But sometimes the way we've been taught, that we are so critical of ourselves. Other people think you're doing a wonderful job, but you say, no, 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 it can't be true. Because we always receive criticism, and we never receive praise. So, for Joy in Kyoto, please carry on and do your report or whatever, and you'll probably find out you're much better than you thought you were. Oh, that's okay, that was Joy, I did Nathan. Meditation, yeah, you just sit meditation there and just show how peaceful you are. That will inspire people much more than anything you can ever say. From United Arab Emirates. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how can I help people who are ignorant and afraid of the Dharma because it contradicts their belief, which is based on Abrahamic religion? You don't need to to contradict it. You just, you know, use different people's ideas. But also, you know, just encourage people to be a little bit... what's the word? Not rebellious, but, you know, to avoid dogma, because there's just too much dogma in the world, which, you know, judges people, which doesn't respect people, different cultures, different ways of looking at life. And you find there are many different ways to look at the same thing. So it's very hard, but little by little, if you're very kind, helpful, you're a good person, then people will respect that and they'll listen. Well, what is your faith, your religion, your path? And then you have an opportunity. Katrina in Scotland. Ajahn Brahm, can you offer some guidance, please? How can we deal with people who are very unkind to us, who are trying to hurt us and cause us difficulties in life by any means possible? My goodness me. Well, probably move away, if you can. Because I don't know why people want to hurt one another. I read this in this little book which I wrote. That Happiness Everyday book. And as it said, if you find other people irritating, then reflect, you're probably irritating other people as well. Which when you admit it, it's probably true. So we do irritate one another. But anyway, if someone's really causing a lot of abuse, then if it's something physical or even emotional, sometimes that you can get the police involved in that. Because, you know, that is not possible to do these days. But if it's, you know, less than, just unkind to you, just if they're unkind to you, don't need to accept it, the unkindness. It's just a little thing the Buddha said. If somebody gives you a gift, a present, you don't want it, then you can send it back again. And it belongs to the person who tried to give it to you. So, no, I don't want that. So I don't know how that can be unkind to you. People try to be unkind to me. I like it when they're unkind to me because it gives me another story I can tell. It's totally unreasonable. Years and years and years ago, when just we were living in Magnolia Street, we had a big, the old VW vans. We used to take all our building material from here down to Serpentine to build a monastery. Just going to adjust my, oops, there it goes better. And I was packing the van up to take it to Serpentine, and this about 14-year-old girl came out from the house next door. She was visiting. She put her hands on her shoulders like this and looked me up with total disrespect and said, "That is sick, dressed up like a girl." I can't repeat exactly how she said it, but it was, you know, she was really trying to upset me. Because, you know, you're a monk, just wearing robes. And it was, she said it so funnily, I just burst out laughing, I cracked up. And she didn't like that I was cracking up. I was supposed to be upset. But that's a wonderful way when people are trying to be unkind to you, just laugh. It's very hard to be angry at someone who's laughing. Anyway, I better be quick here. I suffer from addiction. I really want to stop, but it's really difficult. Can meditation help with my problem? If yes, how? I tried to let it go, but it keeps coming back. Depends what type of addiction it is. Obviously, if it's a physical addiction, like I mentioned about the poor guy who had heroin, it's really tough. But there's many other addictions in life. And, yeah, please get support of friends and neighbours, especially your loved ones. So if it's a substance you're addicted to, just make it hard for you to reach that substance. You know, if it's on the internet and addicted to something like porn or something, just, you know, get some app on there so you can't get to it easy enough. If it's difficult to access, you know, it's not never impossible to access, but if it's difficult to access, then it's easier. And that time when you have that, yeah, I want to do it, and before you can actually achieve your goal, that time is an opportunity where you can realize what you're doing, saying, this is stupid, I don't want to do this. But the other thing with addiction, somebody taught me, if you have an addiction, sometimes people feel deep down that they don't deserve to be free of that addiction. A lack of self-worth, a lack of self-love, a lack of self-kindness. If you have some really good friends you can be around who support you and say, you're not a bad person. And it's really nice to have you around and look after you and talk with you. Really positive friends can sometimes build up your power, that you're worth much more than the addiction. You can say no to it. Please excuse me for talking a bit long. It's 12 minutes past 9 now. But nevertheless, if anyone wishes to ask a question, we have the microphones going around. Is there any questions from our audience here? I can read your minds, because one of the questions is, can we please go home now? So what I'll do, we'll bow three times, and then afterwards, if you need have a question, come up and ask it personally.
Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namami. Very good.